Chapter 8, Ambassador of Goodwill. Cowboys and statesmen, peasants and princes, movie extras and stars, paupers and millionaires, were all one to Will Rogers. Riches in great abundance poured into his coffers. He was feted by the wealthy and by royalty, but he never lost the common touch. He could dine in a palace, but he would just as soon sit down on the ground and munch a sandwich with a laborer on a movie lot. The Prince of Wales laughed at his witticisms, but they were relished equally by the sidling panhandler who bummed him for a dime to buy a cup of coffee. John D. Rockefeller was his friend, but so was the lowest extra in one of his movies. Andrew Mellon chuckled at Will's sage remarks, but so did the countermen at the all-night, one-armed lunchroom where Rogers frequently stopped for a bite to eat. He could talk anyone's language, for he was a friend to the world, but he also carefully explained that while he joked about the wealthy, the statesmen, the social elect, and royalty, he did not look down upon them. They'd be just as good as anybody else if they had an equal chance, he declared. Will Rogers scaled the heights in diplomacy and society when the Prince of Wales commanded him in 1924 to attend a dinner at the Long Island Country Club during the Prince's visit to his country. The Prince had heard Rogers in London and wanted to meet him. All the others at the dinner appeared to be in the strictest of formal attire, but Will arrived at the club wearing his worn blue serge suit and sat down beside the Prince. And it must be recorded that despite his lack of correct evening wear, he stole the show from the Prince. As the repast progressed, Rogers and the Prince kept up a running fire of conversation. The Prince laughed heartily at Will's jests, and when the ambassador without portfolio arose to talk, he made the Prince his one and only target. The heir to England's throne enjoyed it to the uttermost, and occasionally leaned over to twitch Roger's coattail and whisper, "Tell them that one you told me about." "Best feeder I ever had," Rogers declared afterward. "He plugged my act and furnished material at the same time." After the Prince returned to England, Rogers, in his weekly news feature for the McNaught Syndicate, wrote, "Well, the Prince left us. We had no more got rid of him until La Follette came. They just will not let New York settle down to normal. You often hear the expression that a person has left the country flat, but this case of the Prince's departure was the only one in history where he left the country asleep. Long Island went to bed the night he left and has not woke up yet. In fact, they didn't even leave a call. You won't be able to promote another dance on Long Island for years. A lot of men got their wives back, much shop-worn from dancing. The Prince left a trail of broken hearts and turned down hats that won't be forgotten for weeks." Ambassador Rogers. Kings, dictators, presidents, diplomats, prime ministers, and leaders everywhere were friends of Rogers. They all enjoyed his sharp, shrewd observations on the events of the day in their countries. King George, von Hindenburg, Mussolini, Stalin, the late King Albert, Stanley Baldwin, Lloyd George, Clemenceau, and President Calais, the list could go on and on until all the top flight of the leaders of the world were included, knew the unofficial ambassador from the United States. It would be politic, of course, for those in the know to deny it, but it was more than once rumored that Rogers' journeys around the world were not mere pleasure jaunts, but visits that had a very serious purpose behind them. Whether there was such a motive, and it does not seem unlikely, Rogers found in these trips material for witticisms that added to his stature as a commentator on international affairs. None of the recognized students of world affairs ever achieved the recognition from the public that he did, nor were they able to convey the news as Rogers did in homeopathic capsules of misspelled words. Will came back from a world tour in 1926 with doleful comments of the administration troubles in Nicaragua, Mexico, and China, all of which he ascribed to a meddling desire to be helpful. "Every time we start out on a humanitarian mission, we come back with both legs in a sling. Get the humor of our going to Nicaragua to settle an election. personally, I think Nicaragua did pretty good with the little money they've got. Nicaragua is a poor country. One little precinct in Philadelphia did better at the last election. We ought to give them money down there so that they can put on real elections, something like ours. As for Takana Erika, most of us don't know whether Takana Erika is the same as a country or a mouthwash. Now we are messing around with China. You can't even get a gunboat now if you want to take a little excursion. All our gunboats are somewhere up the Yangtze River. Remember, China never bothered any nation in the world. I ain't up on history, but China had civilization 3,000 years before there was anything here, and I never heard of China invading anyone's country. These Chinese get mighty few pleasures out of life, so they thought they'd have a civil war, and they can't even have that without us in England horning in on it. Just like two old busybodies, that's what England and America are. When we had our civil war, some Chinese laundryman might have got a bullet in the neck. Still, China didn't step in, collect our customs for us, and send gunboats up the Mississippi River. Why don't we let them have their war? Now, we've got a lot of missionaries in China. The missionaries have done at least one thing. They've got the Chinese educated up to a civil war. Right now, they're all flocking to Shanghai to be safe. I should think they'd all start converting each other. Not only in Nicaragua, Mexico, and China, but in Europe, the American goes where he isn't welcome. Our tour spent $700 million to be insulted in Europe last year. We're the only nation that goes where we're not wanted. Even at the League of Nations, where we don't belong, we peek in unofficially with the unofficial observers. In describing his trip to Rome and his interview with Mussolini, he said, "I stood in the Roman Forum and I found that they had a Senate in Rome long ago. That's why Rome declined." Boy, if they declined with a Senate, what will they do with a Senate and a House? Rogers was known the world over because of his motion pictures. And his travels in the numerous countries he visited were something like triumphal tours. In 1932, he flew to South America, and in October of that year, while on his way home, the plane was forced down by a storm on the outskirts of Santos, a city in the coffee-growing district of Brazil. When the natives rushed out, they recognized Rogers at once. He was forced to stay in the town overnight, and it was arranged that he appear at the local theater. Will couldn't speak Portuguese, and they couldn't understand English, but he produced a lariat and proceeded to give them a demonstration of roping tricks that spoke a language they all understood. On the way back to the United States, he stopped at Havana, Cuba, where he was the guest of honor at a dinner given by Captain Demarest, American consul at Cuba. It seems of more than passing significance that all the embassies at the Cuban capital were represented. The old blue serge. Will appeared at the dinner in his old blue serge suit. The ambassadors and consuls present were there in full regimentals, with their medals and ribbons, giving a very colorful atmosphere to the dinner. Rogers, when called upon, proceeded to denounce boiled shirts for evening dress in the tropics. The Chinese minister listened to Rogers' jokes, and when he had finished, it was observed that the Oriental hurriedly quit the banquet room. After the repast, an impromptu concert was put on for Will's entertainment. It had just about started when the Chinese minister walked into the room attired in a formal tropical suit of silk. The fashionable gathering applauded, and Will grinned. "I shall be offended," Rogers told that gathering, "if anyone accuses me of making a goodwill tour to Cuba. I believe the honest policy of trade of the West Indies business requires no commercial diplomacy." Rogers was the guest of honor on similar occasions in Shanghai, Moscow, and even in faraway Siam. "A great place, Siam, but puzzling," Rogers remarked. "I didn't see the king, but his father-in-law and mother-in-law gave me a party. His father-in-law is his uncle. Don't try to figure that out." In commenting upon Russian affairs, Rogers said, "Russia's a country that used to have four exports: dukes, grand dukes, princesses, and whiskers." Of Stalin, he commented, "Of course, him being a dictator, he's allowed certain extensive privileges. The government in Russia owns everything. Well, that ain't so different than over here. The banks own it over here." I am about the only person that ever talked about Russia that admits that I don't know anything about it, Roger said. And on the other hand, I know just as much about it as everybody that ever talked about it. Nobody knows anything about Russia. It's too complicated. Observations on China. In one of his Sunday feature articles, he masked some exceedingly astute observations on China in a glowing eulogy of Pearl Buck, noted novelist. Rogers wrote, "Well, all I know is just what I read in the papers or what I run it onto here and there. I was just sitting here a while ago reading a long article about Pearl Buck, the author of those books about Chinese life. Just a few days before leaving New York prior to the election, Mrs. Rogers and I had the pleasure of spending an hour or more with this very remarkable woman. How it came about was that last year when I was over in China, I read one of those of her books on a boat when I wasn't arguing with Floyd Gibbons. Well, I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever read, so I talked to lots of people over there about her. A Dr. Donaldson, whom I met on a train from Peking to Shanghai, had known the family of this girl for years. He and they both were early missionaries out there. I wanted to meet her while out there. She lived up at Nanking, that's the capital of China, or was that week. It used to be Peking, and if the southern crowd kept getting stronger, I guess it will be Canton. I wanted to go up to Nanking anyhow. I had come through there on a train from Peking, but didn't get to see much, so I called up the school where they lived. Her husband is a professor in a big university there. He has made a study of agriculture and is a graduate of Cornell. By the way, that always struck me as being the oddest place for an agricultural course. You just kind of look for them out in the Midwest where they raise something. I got a communication with them up at Nanking and was to go up and see her on a certain day. I was going to fly, and there was a line of seaplanes that went right up the Yangtze River. I got to the plane to take off that day, and it was raining and cloudy all day, so I didn't get to go. I was leaving on the boat the next day for Singapore, then for the flight across India and all points west. I talked to Mr. Buck, her husband, over the phone, but not seeing her out there was a great disappointment, for she is one person that wrote a book about a country, and even that country liked it. I never heard a derogatory, and that's a pretty hot word for me, ain't it, word about the book. The Chinese say it was true to life and character. Her publishers knew what a great admirer I was of hers, so when I landed in South America and Mrs. Rogers met me in New York, why, they phoned us and said Mrs. Buck would be in New York at a certain time and would see us. We were tickled to death. We went over to her hotel. Her husband is taking a special course again at Cornell. He is quite an agricultural authority in China and has held some very important government missions in regard to trying to get them straightened out on what to raise. She, too, I think, was taking some course up there. So she stayed there most all the time. She just come down to New York occasionally. She didn't like it so much. She is not so hot for this hero worship business. She is very modest and wonderfully interesting to talk to. She almost speaks with an accent. She has spoken Chinese so long. After Sons, which was another powerful book, she is working on the third and last of the series. You know, if you know you're Chinese, there is quite a big communistic hold in certain parts of China. The influence is growing rapidly, and they want her to show that it will be through communism that China will eventually be saved. I don't know what they are supposed to be saved from, for they have the best mode of life and living in the world now. But somebody is always saving China from something or another. She said in The Good Earth that while she didn't write it in Chinese, that her thoughts were all in Chinese. That is, her characters were all talking to each other in Chinese. Then as she translated the very words into English, before writing them down, some of the reviewers got the idea that it was Old Testament writing, or a throwback to her missionary training. She denies that and says it came from these words being the very ones the Chinese utter in a literal translation. Letters of a Self-Made Diplomat. One classic that Will Rogers wrote on international affairs was printed in the Saturday Evening Post in 1926 and later in his book, Letters of a Self-Made Diplomat to His President. In it, he said, "We don't stand like a horse thief abroad. Whoever told you that is flattering us. We don't stand as good as a horse thief. These guys over here are so busy celebrating our unpopularity that they don't stop to look around to see how they stand themselves. If you can find me one nation in Europe that has a sincere regard for any other nation, I will jump out of the top of the Washington Monument and see if Jackie Coogan can catch me as I fall. France and England think as much of each other as two rival bands of Chicago bootleggers. Spain and France have the same regard for each other as Fort Worth and Dallas. Russia hates everybody so bad it would take her a week to pick out the one she hates most. Poland is raring to fight. Turkey has been laying off 3 months now without any war, and peace is just killing them. Bulgaria is feeding an army and deriving no benefits whatsoever. Greece has open time they are trying to fill. Czechoslovakia is a new country. Mussolini is raising 500,000 children every year and needs somewhere to stake them out. Portugal would like to join somebody in a war. Germany, the winner of the last war, is about the only one not looking for trouble." From London, Rogers wrote the following cable to President Coolidge. Cal Cool, White House White. Former Secretary of State Hughes had an interview with former Premier Briand of France, but nothing official transpired, as neither carried an employee's card. Russia wants to discuss debt repayments with us. If you promise to pay America, it will loan you twice as much as you promised to pay. Wise guys, those Russians. Yours in exile, Will Rog. That Will Rogers visit in foreign countries were not all fun or his own pleasure was attested by the late Ambassador Dwight W. Morrow, who admitted he took Rogers to Mexico when relations between that country and the United States needed smoothing out. "I had my most satisfactory interview with President Calais after Rogers made him laugh," Morrow declared. Again, after Rogers made his airplane flight over Nicaragua and contributed $50,000 for the earthquake sufferers, Secretary of State Stimson called him in to conference on conditions thereupon his return. When Will was on his way to the Orient in 1931, he observed, "Japan is going to hear the awfulest compliments, as I hear they don't stand for any wisecracks. Also, I don't speak their language, and I'm having lots of trouble with my own." One of his most quoted comments on politics had a word of praise for Mussolini. Mussolini could run his country with his eyes shut. In fact, that's the way our Congress has been running it. On his return from one of his trips to London, he declared, "I told him 2 weeks ago in London that the bankers there bet on their government. Over here, the bankers bet against it. The folks over there wouldn't think of going against England. It's a sort of patriotism." Of the peace covenant, he wrote, "It says in there, there is to be no more war." And there is a paragraph further down telling you where to get your ammunition in case there was one. Another shrewd comment on international politics was made in New York at a luncheon shortly after the war, when he remarked, "The only way to get ahead of Mr. Enright, Commissioner of New York Police, is to walk in front of him. Why, he even seems to have had business in Europe. He's the only official I know of who has been over there since the war on business." Secretary Hughes has been traveling, and Secretary Denby and others, well, the new slogan, they tell me, is this: join the cabinet and see the world. But what's the use? You're sure to run into a war somewhere. My idea of stopping wars is to have nations act like individuals. If they don't like each other, move. Let France move to Japan and have Japan move to France. Then if Japan and Germany got into a war, who would worry? Why, America would run excursions to a war like that. Chapter 9. Rogers and Politics. As a commentator on the ever-changing political scene, Will Rogers was the court gesture to the nation. But behind his straight-shooting barbs of humor was a sound wisdom that was eagerly sought by the high officials who were his targets. The line from Shakespeare's King Lear, "Gestures do oft prove prophets," was demonstrated as a truism time and again by Rogers. Instead of creating ill feeling by his remarks, many felt honored at being so noticed. It was related that a certain United States senator felt slighted because Rogers had not included him in a radio speech in which he lampooned Senator Borah. If you'd do as much for me as you did for Bill Borah, I'd be famous, the slighted senator commented. Rogers had no political ambitions himself, although he was proposed for president several times. He started his own presidential boom just as a joke in 1924, but 4 years later, political observers were considering the question seriously. Rogers is a statesman, experienced, courageous, safe, and sound, and offers excellent material for the presidency, declared Representative Everett B. Howard on the floor of Congress. Ha, chuckled Rogers. Do you want a president who is funny on purpose? A comedian can only last until he takes himself serious or his audience takes him serious, and I don't want either of those to happen to me, so let's stop all this foolishness right now. A few days later, in an article in the Saturday Evening Post, he formally withdrew as a candidate. He further suggested that Governor Alfred E. Smith decline the 1928 nomination for the Democratic Party and wait to run 4 years later. He predicted then that the Democrats would win by a large majority in 1932. Political experts later declared that had Smith accepted Rogers' advice, he might have followed President Hoover. After Herbert Hoover was nominated by the Republican Party and Governor Smith by the Democrats, Rogers invented the Bunkless Party with himself as the candidate for president. I want it understood, first off, that my platform is made out of the planks carried in by the voters. Anyone with 10 votes can have a plank. We are leaving room between planks for any wisecracks that we think should be inserted. We also will not only give the farmer relief, we'll cure him of being a farmer. Famous election broadcast. At the Friars Club in New York on the eve of the 1928 election, Rogers listened to his brother members telling how Friar Al Smith could not possibly lose the following day. I like Al Smith, Rogers drawled, but you fellows are going to wake up tomorrow and find there is a big country west of the Hudson River. One of the most famous satires on politics was delivered during a radio broadcast over the Columbia Network on November 11, 1934. He said, "Well, this is the last night you're going to be pestered with me for a while. I'm off for 5 Sundays, but in 6 weeks from tonight, why, get ready to tune me out. Now, I got a lot of countries I want to talk to about later on in this winter. I've been written 1,000 letters about Russia and all these other places and asked a lot of questions that I haven't been able to answer, and I wanted to talk. I wanted to do a little bit on it tonight, but something has happened that made me kind of alter my whole program for tonight. A friend passed away since I talked with you last Sunday night, and I wouldn't feel right if I didn't change my program to say a few words about him. Well, I can't be eloquent, and I can't be worthy of doing it, but I'm going to try and make up in sincerity and feeling what I lack in words. When you've heard of somebody since childhood, well then, as you grow up and met him and come to know him and to like him and to see him become almost a tradition, then see him pass out right when it should have been the most useful years of his life. I don't know. It kind of gets me. He'd been ill, but he was feeling more hopeful. But last Tuesday, about 7, he started having acute pains, and as the day went on, they got worse. They called in what little medical help they had, but it was feared he was beyond human aid, and by nightfall, just as the sun was setting, he breathed his last. This gallant old figure, who had been loved by many, feared by many, had gone to where there's no returning. All that was mortal of the Republican Party had left this earth. Don't applaud. Don't applaud, boys. They're dying. He passed away. He passed away because he wanted to live like a pioneer. He couldn't change with modern civilization. The word spread like wildfire. The news was flashed to our four corners of our land. From the nostrils of every static radio belched forth the news. The king is dead. The king is dead. It struck us like a thunderbolt, and we knew that he was ill. We knew that he had really never recovered from that stroke, which he had in October of 1929, a paralytic stroke brought on by a loss of marginal blood. That stroke laid him low, and it happened just when he was at the height of his career, just when things looked the brightest for him, just when he was bragging of being rugged. Oh, so rugged. why there was not a dark cloud that he could not see on his horizon. He was made practically bedridden. It was the unexpected that struck him and his immediate family. He'd been warned, but not by any of his own doctors or close friends. But he'd been warned by outsiders that he was living a little too high, and it was liable to bring on a fluttering heart. But he scoffed at him. What do they know about me and my health? They're just jealous of my ruddy condition. They can't match my power, and they're envious. I'll keep on living like this forever. I've solved the problem of power, mass energy. Ah, that's it, mass energy, and we've solved it. And then came the dawn. But just give the old boy credit. When the blow hit him, and he was bright right up to the finish, he was bright. In October, in 29, with no climatic warning, he lived up to all political, he lived right up to it, all political tradition. He said, it wasn't my fault. And it wasn't his fault. It was everybody's fault. It was your fault. It was my fault. It was the Lord's fault. He just stepped in and said, wait a minute. How long has this thing been going on here? This living on the dog-eat-dog principle. We'll stop this thing right here now and give the folks a chance to reorganize and redeem yourselves. That's what the Lord told them. Now, here's where the mistake was made. The Republicans held a clinic at that very moment and decided, boys, our patient is sick. He's got acute appendicitis. Now, of course, an operation is going to cost us all something, and we're all going to have to chip in. It will take part of what we have, but it may save us in the long run. There is a change coming in our lives, and we can't do the things we've always done. We can no more ask for the same conditions to continue than we can ask for our youth to continue. Now, had that been done, why, this obituary notice that was posted on every crossroad last Tuesday night might not have been put there. But instead, they decided to, at the clinic, that it really wasn't appendicitis at all, that it was just a cramped colic, and that a strong, healthy man like he was, he could just throw it off, you know. He'd always been healthy, and there was no reason he should be sick, and the only thing to do was just let nature take its course, that they had always come out of these cramps without having to give up anything, and there was no reason why this one should be any different. As I say, from October 1929 to November 4th, 1932, get that date, November 4th, 1932, on that date, nature took its course again. The patient had another stroke, and they still said they wouldn't have to operate. And they rushed with the ice bags again, but not with the knife. They still contended that they was right and the disease was wrong. Well, in an argument with a disease, it be physical or economical, you'd better give him a hearing anyhow. But in spite of all his pain, in spite of all his groans, the doctors and his whole family maintained he was fundamentally sound, that he had never been operated on his whole life and had lived this long, and that they could see no reason to think that this same life program and schedule should not go on as it always had. So he had his third and last stroke Tuesday. He went to his maker, a physical wreck, but fundamentally sound. And on his tombstone it says, here lies a rugged individual, but he wasn't rugged enough to compete with the Democrats. Now, we come to that grave question of reincarnation. Does the soul return in another body? I believe it does. I don't know much about it, but I really believe that it returns in another body. I don't know what animal he'll come back in. I don't know. It won't be as big as an elephant. I know that. It will be something with much less humility. It will be a domestic animal, some very domestic animal, an animal more in the nature of a dog. It will have faith. Its whole soul will be consecrated to service. Will this animal be needed? It certainly will be, for the Democrats by that time will have passed out through too much power. Democrats could never stand power as long as the Republicans could, because they never was used to it. They're getting cocky already, and they've only been in there overnight. So the Republicans, being the first to die, they'll be the first to come back. So let's say a good word for the diseased and tell them to be ready to move over in his grave. The Democrats will be crawling in there with him pretty soon. Alfalfa Bill endorses Rogers. In the 1932 Democratic National Convention at Chicago, Alfalfa Bill Murray, former governor of Oklahoma, startled the gathering when on the second vote, he threw Oklahoma's 22 votes to Will Rogers. The cowboy philosopher, who had entered upon the political stage of the country through the back door of criticism, did not take the shift in his direction very seriously. As a matter of fact, when the votes were recorded for him, he was peacefully dozing in the press box. Politicians and the public thought that Bill Murray was indulging in another of his practical jokes. Some even expressed the opinion that Rogers was not the only gag man that Oklahoma produced. Yet Murray was serious. He was convinced that Will Rogers would have made a great president and a popular one. Murray and Rogers had been friends for years, and the former governor knew Will's father when the two had served on the Constitutional Convention at the admission of Indian Territory into the Union as the state of Oklahoma. "The world never knew Rogers' great depth of character and intellect," Murray declared. "I regarded him not as a country's foremost humorist, but rather as a clear thinker, a man of rare wisdom, and a born statesman." Political observers credited Rogers with being largely responsible for causing California to vote in the Democratic column for Franklin D. Roosevelt that year. Normally, California went Republican by 2 and 3 to 1. Rogers' influence was exerted when Roosevelt and his campaign party were about to visit Los Angeles, where he was scheduled for one of the more important speeches of the campaign. Mayor John Porter was a Republican, and he declared that he would not welcome in an official capacity a candidate who believed in the repeal of Prohibition. Roosevelt backers feared Porter's decision would be detrimental to their nominee, and they were in a quandary. Rogers, a lifelong Democrat, heard of the difficulty and offered to make the welcoming speech. The Roosevelt rally was to be held in the Coliseum, and every one of the 100,000 seats in the place was sold at prices ranging from $1 to $5 each. Rogers himself bought $1,800 worth of tickets and gave them away to stenographers, stagehands, and extras on the movie lot. The night of the rally, Rogers was never in better form, and of course, his principal target was Mayor Porter. He bombarded the Republicans with good-natured barbs of humor, and the gathering proved to be the turning point in the campaign in California. When the final returns were counted, it was found that Mayor Porter's action had turned into a boomerang, and California had gone Democrat for the first time in 16 years. Politics Rogers' target. On the movie lot at Movie Tone City, fellow actors used to say that when Will Rogers met anyone for the first time, he would ask whether the visitor was a Democrat or a Republican. It was said that he put this question to a famous wealthy Easterner who had sought an introduction to Rogers. "Republican," replied the Easterner. "Shucks, that's too bad," Will is reported to have said. "We'll see you tomorrow." The last part of the humorous remarks, according to the legend, was delivered over Rogers' shoulder as he walked away from the astounded visitor. John J. Ruskob, former national chairman of the Democratic Party, however, was brought out to the Rogers Ranch for a visit when he arrived on the Pacific Coast. One morning, Will routed him out of bed and brought him a great industrialist down to the corral where Rogers put on a thrilling exhibition of roping, bulldogging, and tying steers. "The best way to hog tie an ornery steer quick is to pretend he's a Republican," Rogers told Ruskob. Then before Ruskob could catch his breath from laughter, Rogers sent over the following like the crack of a bull whip: "Darned if I don't think most of them are." The Democrats, however, did not escape, and he found much in the New Deal of President Roosevelt to criticize in his gentle fashion. Congress was his favorite target at all times. "Now this is a very momentous Congress that is in session now," Will said a few months before his death. "Mr. Roosevelt is trying to get rid of them. They have appropriated more money than any Congress ever did, But I guess that's all right. We're not paying our national debt anyhow, so it doesn't matter how much it is anyway. Senator Huey P. Long, the filibustering Democrat from Louisiana, who died from an assassin's bullet, more than once provided Rogers with material for witticism, commenting on the night the King Fish conducted his all-night filibuster in the Senate. Rogers said, at that, he pulled the biggest and most educational novelty ever introduced in the Senate. He read the Constitution of the United States. A lot of them thought it was that he was reviewing a new book. During Roosevelt's campaign in 1932, the phrase, the forgotten man, was coined and used it until it became threadbare. When Roosevelt announced the personnel of his cabinet, most of them were names new to national affairs, which caused Rogers to remark, scurrying through Who's Who, the World Almanac, and the United States Fingerprint Department, trying to find out who they were, I can say the forgotten man has been found. There's nine of them and a woman. William Jennings Bryan, the great commoner, who made three unsuccessful bids for president on the Democratic ticket, felt the force of Will's barbed shafts during the Democratic National Convention, to which both had been assigned as special writers. While seated in the section reserved for the press, Rogers kept up a steady stream of humorous comment. The reporters, bent on getting their copy into the newspapers on time, were sometimes annoyed, but in spite of themselves, they frequently had to stop and laugh at Rogers' remarks. Something Rogers said or wrote irritated the pompous Bryan, and he took occasion to call Rogers' attention to it. I am a humorous writer, said Will, apparently very humble, but with a suspicious twinkle in his eye. Bryan drew himself up stiffly and replied, I am a serious writer. Maybe we are both wrong, countered Rogers. Ridicules American politics. Will could always be depended upon to point out the ridiculous in the American political sense, as was evidenced on the occasion when a senator arose to read into the congressional record one of Rogers' comments. Another senator objected to the procedure. This other senator rose and said, does the gentleman yield? Will declared. They always call each other gentlemen in there. By the tone they put in the word, it would be more appropriate if they come right out and said, does the coyote from Maine yield? When the man from Maine says, I yield, for if he don't, the other guy keeps on talking anyhow. So the coyote from Maine says, I yield to the polecat from Oregon. So when all the yielding and objections is over, the other senator said, I object to the remarks of the professional joker being put into the congressional record. Taking a dig at me, see? And they didn't want any outside fellow contributing. Well, he had me wrong. Compared to them, I'm an amateur. And the thing about my jokes is that they don't hurt anybody. You can say they're not funny, or they're terrible, or they're good, or whatever it is, but they do no harm. But with Congress, every time they make a joke, it's a law. And every time they make a law, it's a joke. But more than one politician attested that Rogers had counseled and aided them through his writings and speeches. At a dinner before the exclusive Gridiron Club in Washington, Eddie Cantor related that a prominent statesman described Rogers as America's policeman. He is without doubt the most potent individual influence in our national affairs, the statesman told Cantor. And that goes for the president, the cabinet, and the financiers who are supposed to wield such an influence over legislation. Congressmen have found out through bitter experience that their constituents pay more attention to what Will Rogers says in that little daily newspaper box than to a decision of the Supreme Court. A few adverse words from Rogers means sure death for any piece of legislation. But of Congress, Will said, there is no credit to being a comedian. When you have the whole government working for you, all you have to do is report the facts. I don't even have to exaggerate. Presidents enjoy jokes. Rogers began kidding presidents during the Wilson administration, just before the United States entered the World War. Rogers was starring in a show, and President Wilson went from Washington to Baltimore to see it when it played in that city. Trouble was brewing on the Mexican border, and the punitive expedition of the United States had failed in its attempt to capture the Mexican rebel leader, Pancho Villa. Criticism was being hurled from all sides at the government for the unpreparedness of the army. There is some talk of getting a machine gun if we can borrow one, said Rogers, spinning his lariat and looking over at President Wilson. The one we have now, they are using to train our army at Plattsburgh. If we go to war, we'll just have to go to the trouble of getting another gun. President Wilson, who found his chief recreation in attending vaudeville and musical comedies, laughed heartily at Rogers, and the comedian realized that the head of the nation could take a joke in the spirit in which it was intended. President Wilson, continued Rogers, is getting along fine now to what he was a few months ago. Do you realize, people, that at one time in our negotiations with Germany, he was five notes behind? The president never laughed more uproariously at a joke, and the theater went wild. It was something new in the experience of theatergoers to have a president join in the fun. It was one of the most successful nights that Rogers ever enjoyed on stage. Overnight guest at White House. In October 1926, after Rogers had returned from abroad, where he wrote that series of side-splitting letters of a self-made diplomat to his president, President Coolidge wired an invitation to him to visit the White House as an overnight guest. Rogers was overwhelmed. If it's a joke, Rogers wired in reply, head me off at Philadelphia. It was no joke, however, and Coolidge sat up until late at night talking to Rogers. I am the only Democrat who has slept in the White House for a long time, said Rogers in describing the visit. Of course, the president's not understood. He's a nice fellow with a sense of humor, and we spent last night swapping yarns. About 8 o'clock, the president began to yawn, and at 10, he fell asleep on me. Coolidge was responsible for many of Rogers' jests. But one of the best stories of the two men was prompted by Will's bosom companion, Irving S. Cobb, the famous writer. The two were about to meet Coolidge for the first time, and the president's solemnity on all occasions caused Cobb to remark, I'll bet you can't make him smile. As the president shook hands with Rogers, he said something through his tight lips. Will leaned over as though to hear better and said, pardon me, I didn't get the name. The president smiled. When Coolidge quit the White House after his term in office had expired and went back to live in his modest double house in Northampton, Massachusetts, Rogers paid tribute to him in this manner. There was evidence of the real American. No fuss, no crowds. Can't you picture it? A man going from the White House to a smaller abode where he hands out $47.50 rent. That was the most remarkable part of his administration. He was able to find a house at that rent. Rogers used to tell of a gridiron dinner that he attended at Washington, where the table was so big that President Hoover, at one end of it, was in the District of Columbia, and he sat at the other end in the state of Virginia. They lined up the ambassadors near President Hoover, he would relate, in the manner of one imparting a state secret. They were seated according to how much they owed Uncle Sam. The ones that owed the most sat near the president. Down at my end of the table were the South American ambassadors. They couldn't see or hear much, and they grumbled. I tipped them off to get their countries to borrow a few billion dollars from us. The social war that raged in Hoover's administration over the place of Mrs. Dolly Gann, sister of Vice President Curtis, should occupy at presidential functions was described by Rogers as a scrap over who should sit next to the president. Curtis's job, he said, was to bang the gavel for the opening of the Senate with a prayer and the closing with an investigation. At the 1932 Democratic National Convention, Will Rogers was as prominent as Al Smith and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Eddie Dowling, musical comedy star, introduced his old friend to the convention, and for 15 minutes, the Smith and Roosevelt factions forgot their differences as they roared at Will's jibes at the leaders of the Democratic Party. Every morning at the convention, he would go over to the Oklahoma delegation and greet them. The group occupied seats in front of the press box. Among the delegates were several close friends. Good morning, you old coyotes, he would shout in a voice that could be heard all over the hall. If ever there was a delegation that was a disgrace to a state, it's you bunch of boys. See that you behave yourselves today. The delegation would reply with some similar insult, and Rogers would laugh heartily as he walked away. As great as his affection obviously was for Al Smith, Rogers was extremely fond of President Roosevelt and he delighted in telling of a visit to the White House and found the president laughing uproariously. The president, he said, was sitting in bed at the time with newspapers around him. He was laughing, Will said, at what the papers said about him. Pokes fun at administration. But Roosevelt's policies did not escape unscathed from his piercing barbs. When the United States went off the gold standard, Roosevelt, according to reports, was very much annoyed when Rogers described the Supreme Court as the nine old men in kimonos who were going to force the Democrats to return the 41 cents they had taken from the Republican dollar. Another poke at Roosevelt and his brain trust was contained in his argument that the farm problem might be solved if every farmer would eat all that he raised, then he would not only get fat himself, but farm products might probably go up. Of course, on account of this, not being an economist idea, he continued, it might not work. Rogers was a lifelong Democrat, but he studiously avoided partisanship. He contributed to the Democratic campaign funds, but at the same time, he frequently appeared on benefit programs to raise money for the Republican Treasury. Republican leaders sought his counsel in their campaigns as often did the Democrats. Of his own political affiliation, he once said, I am not a member of any organized party. I am a Democrat. Mayor of Beverly Hills. Will Rogers once was known as the mayor of Beverly Hills, but the fact of the matter was that he never was anything more than honorary mayor. It was all a joke, and for 2 years he pretended he was a political boss of the movie picture colony. He took the oath of office on December 2nd, 1926, after Douglas Fairbanks had made the introductory speech. The Los Angeles Fire Department band played The Old Gray Mare, and Will made his inaugural address while the throng roared with laughter. I am for the common people, he declared, and as Beverly Hills has no common people, I'll sure to make good. He promised to see that the poor of the city would be given bigger and better private swimming pools and miles of new bridle paths on which to canter to work up an appetite for breakfast. His constituents later complained that as mayor, he spent very little time in town. I confess, he replied, I've been running around the country exhibiting myself, and I'll tell you the answer. I am God's gift to those who didn't see Queen Marie.